Open to Philippians chapter 1, so we'll begin this morning.
Really excited to be with you this weekend and to share some with you about the work in Philadelphia and to share with you about the work going here. It's been really encouraging. Got to meet with Earl and Philip yesterday, and he says mostly good things about you, and it's all been really wonderful. Just encouraged by your faith and your dedication, and on a Saturday morning, wow, just wanting to get together to be like this. To be praising God and reading His Word together. I'll share more about the work in Philadelphia, Lord willing, tomorrow morning during the class period. But today we just want to talk some more about what it looks like to live for Christ and that our life is about Christ. We'll hit that more as we look at reasons to rejoice today. It's the title of our lesson. Looking at Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 26, there's no doubt that Paul's letter here to the church in Philippi is just full of joy. He is constantly referring to this tone throughout Philippians. It's not the theme of Philippians, but it is certainly the flavor of it. In chapter 1, verses 3 through 4, Paul wrote, "I thank my God in all my remembrance of you always in every prayer of mine for you all, making my prayer with joy." In chapter 2, in verse 2, he wrote, "Complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind." And then later in chapter 2, verse 29, Paul gave instruction regarding the messenger Epaphroditus. Epaphroditus was one who came and delivered the funds that the church in Philippi had sent to him. And he said to receive him in the Lord with all joy. And then in chapter 3, verse 1, like a preacher who's only halfway done, and he says, finally, Paul's still got lots to say, but in chapter 3, verse 1, he says, "Finally, my brothers, rejoice in the Lord. To write the same things to you is no trouble to me, and it's safe for you." That means that we are in danger of not rejoicing. There's a threat that we would not rejoice in the Lord as we should, or that we would rejoice in other things rather than in the Lord. We would find our comfort and our security and our hope in other things. And so in chapter 4, verse 4, Paul writes, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say, rejoice." Joy or rejoicing is mentioned by my count 14 times in this rather short letter. There's a lot going on in this letter, but 14 times in such few verses is a lot. It's such a rich and vibrant thread through the letter, but also through the tapestry that is Paul's life. Paul was one who would rejoice before the Lord even in the most difficult of circumstances. We referred last night to Acts 16 when he and Silas were in prison. What were they doing? They were singing hymns and praising God. And so joy was certainly something that gave Paul strength during trying times. But the question we want to ask this morning is, how is it that Paul managed such joy in his life when the circumstances were unfavorable, to say the least? In fact, if you look at chapter 2, verses 17 through 18, Paul wrote this. He said, "Even if I'm to be poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I'm glad and rejoice with you all. Likewise, you also should be glad and rejoice with me." Now, just in case we're not following the metaphorical language here, many commentators will suggest that when Paul says, "I'm being poured out," if I'm to be poured out, he's talking about his death. He's talking about being beheaded. And so Paul says, if this is to happen, if I'm to lose my life for the sake of the gospel, then I'm going to rejoice and you should rejoice with me. And I'm thinking, Paul, you're out of your mind. What do you mean you should be rejoicing? This is terrible. But Paul was able to manage such joy, and we're going to consider four areas in his life that I think you'll be able, and I will be able, to empathize with. I've not faced what Paul faced, but there are times when what Paul has gone through seems really relevant to my life, and we'll look at that here in Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 26. To begin with, let's just read verses 12 through 14, where Paul writes, "I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. So it's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear." Now, Paul was arrested in Jerusalem on baseless charges. He had traveled to Jerusalem. He had taken some Gentiles with him, but he had not taken them with him to the temple, where he was accused by some of the Jews of coming in and talking about the law of Moses and changing the law of Moses and speaking against the temple and the holy place, really similar to the accusations actually that were brought against Stephen several chapters before when Paul had held the coats of those who stoned Stephen to death. But those were baseless charges. He was then held in Caesarea for 2 years, waiting trial, waiting to be set free. And when it was apparent that he wasn't going to get a fair shake, he said, "I appeal to Caesar," and they sent him to Rome. And through a tumultuous journey, nearly lost his life multiple times on the journey, whether it was first being attacked on the way to Caesarea, which failed, or it was being shipwrecked and lost at sea, which he managed to survive that, he and the whole ship, or this being bitten by a viper on the island there. Paul was threatened multiple times on the journey. And when he finally got to where he was going, he was told to stay put for 2 years. Luke tells us at the end of Acts that that's where he stayed, in Rome, waiting trial. Talk about things getting hung up in court. And Paul, through all of this, in this situation, if it had been me, I think I would have turned my face to the wall and turned my back to the door and said, "Enough is enough. Just let me know when it's over. I'm done." Whatever good God wanted to happen in this moment is not happening, and I'm just waiting. And I'm just sitting here waiting for the results of something that's completely beyond my control. Instead, what Paul did was he leaned into his situation, and he looked for opportunities, and he found them abundantly, even while he was in chains. So here he is. He's under house arrest. So if you have pictures of Paul in a dungeon somewhere, the chains, probably not the picture. But he can't go anywhere. He's being guarded night and day by the Praetorian Guard, and he's wearing chains. And so he looked at this as an opportunity because he was prioritizing Christ and his kingdom. And so he got to watch the gospel advance even while he's being held captive, because the gospel's not captive. And so Paul's here in prison, and I want you to imagine the guards who are on duty. I don't know exactly how this worked out. Some of you who study Roman history could probably tell me, "Justin, you got it wrong." But what I imagine is that they're on duty, maybe 12-hour shifts or something, and one guard goes on duty, and Paul's sitting there. I mean, this is the guard's first day, right? And so Paul says, "What's your name? Where are you from?" "Oh, yeah, I've been there before." "Yeah, really wonderful place. Beautiful, right? I bet you miss it. You have family back there?" I have some friends back there. I miss them a lot. I love them. Good people." "No, we're not related, but they're my brothers." "Oh, well, we follow Jesus." "Well, he died a long time ago, but you see, he was raised from the dead." "Oh, you don't believe me? Well, let me explain." And he just gets into the situation. He starts sharing with him and talking with him. And this guard is on duty for 12 hours, and he's a captive audience. And so Paul is going to fill him with this truth, and through evidence and through support of just his own life and what he's been willing to do, and just looking through the scriptures, he's going to be talking to him 12 hours on, 12 hours off. "Excuse me, are you a religious man? Are you interested in these things? Think Acts 17. Do you worship much?" And just getting into his life and learning about him and letting him learn about Christ. And before all said and done, that guard has gotten off duty. He's back talking with the other guards. "And have you seen this guy, Paul?" And word gets around. So that by the end of this letter, look at Philippians chapter 4, verse 21. Paul's going to conclude his letter to the saints in Philippi saying, "Greet every saint in Christ Jesus, the brothers who with me greet you. All the saints greet you, especially those of Caesar's household." And I can just see the glimmer in Paul's eye when he has that pinned. It's like, you guys just don't even know the power of this thing. You just keep at it. Okay? You may think you're in closed doors. You may think that you're bound, but the gospel's not bound, and you just keep teaching, keep preaching. And so how else was Paul going to get this kind of audience? How else was he going to be able to reach into the house of Caesar like this, except that God arranged for it that Paul would be in prison? And what's more, as a result of Paul's boldness in chapter 1, he says that his awareness to take advantage of those kinds of opportunities had resulted in others speaking up and being bold as well. I mean, if Paul can speak up in such circumstances, then why not me? If Paul could get past himself and get past the discouragement and get past the barriers, then what excuses do I have? There's a hymn that we sing. It's an older hymn. "Am I a soldier of the cross?" And it includes this line: "Must I be carried to the skies on flowery beds of ease, while others fought to win the prize and sailed through bloody seas?" There are people in this world who are making daily sacrifices and threats to their lives for the sake of following Christ. And I'm afraid to talk to my neighbor. The gospel's not bound. Whatever I'm thinking, whatever my situation is, the gospel's not bound, and I can work through that, and I can push into that, and I can seek opportunities. And sometimes when I think of the challenges that I face in proclaiming the gospel, I like to think of my brother, my friend, Dan Kane. Some of you may know Dan. He's in Sierra Leone now, he and his wife and their two children. And they moved their family to Sierra Leone, Africa, to preach the gospel. Now, Dan's a good friend of mine. He and I were co-workers in Boston together. Dan's younger than I am. And it was a situation where we were in Boston and we were praying for an older, wiser, more mature Christian to come and help us. And God sent us Dan Kane. What a blessing he was. He just fit those needs precisely in ways that I could not have imagined. But at some point, Dan got to seeing some opportunity in Sierra Leone, and they decided they were going to move there. He and his wife, Sonia, moved. And at some point, Dan fell ill with malaria and typhoid and dengue, all three of which, any one of those could kill you. And the doctor said that if he had arrived in Freetown a little hour later, he probably would not have made it. And rather than pack his bags and head back to home, Dan stayed put. And he and his family still serve in Sierra Leone, because his home is not in America. His home is not in Sierra Leone. You see, you can put up with anything when you remember that your home's not here. Paul's home wasn't in Rome. It wasn't in Tarsus. It wasn't in Antioch. His home was where he wanted everyone around him to go, which was to the Lord, where Christ is in heaven. And so to advance the gospel, I now can preach with more boldness because of examples like Dan, examples like some of you, who I know are facing difficult circumstances, but you're choosing to get past that and say, look, maybe I'm in this imprisoned situation, but I know what Christ can do here. And so you and I may never be in that exact situation, but let me ask you, have you ever felt stuck? Have you ever felt like life is just resisting you and obstructing your path, and you're not making any progress where you'd really like to go? Now, I want to encourage you then to consider looking at your situation not as a detour from your goal, but rather as an assignment from Jesus for His. Maybe there's someone that you're supposed to reach with the gospel. Maybe you're just meant to endure in order to be an encouragement to other people. That's an assignment. That's an assignment from Christ. And maybe it's not hardships and frustrations and obstacles. Maybe, in fact, your path has looked a lot rosier. And you've had all sorts of pleasant things happen to you. Well, that's not much of a prison, is it? But still look for opportunities there. Because it may be that instead of feathering our nests and making ourselves comfortable here, we should be looking at that as an opportunity. Maybe there are people here that I could be serving. Maybe you've arrived for just such a time as this. In the book of Esther, Mordecai sends word to his daughter, cousin. She's queen now. And she hasn't heard about the dangers that are threatening their people. And so he sends word to her that they're in trouble. And she says, look, if I go before the king, I could die. I could lose my life. He hasn't called me for some time now. And if I appear before him in court unannounced, then the rule is all he has to do is not extend his scepter, and I'm dead. And Mordecai, don't you know, he says, that God could arrange for salvation from any other place? But there in Esther 4, he says, who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? You know, maybe you'll miss the job promotion if you hold to godly principles. Maybe you'll be ostracized by your friends if you speak up about Jesus. Maybe you'll be marked as the weirdo on the block if you invite your neighbor to read the Bible with you. What Esther says is, if I perish, I perish. And hers was real danger. I don't suppose you and I are facing that sort of thing. If I perish, I perish is a statement of mission. It's a statement of commitment. It's an assignment. You and I are in a mission field. I'm not in Sierra Leone, but this is your mission field. This is my mission field. And I've got to see it as an assignment. Paul saw his imprisonment not as a derailment from his mission. It was his assignment from the Lord. A friend of mine wrote a parody of the hymn, Anywhere with Jesus. Anywhere with Jesus I can safely go. I want to be in Jesus' boat, but I don't want to row. The Father sent his only Son to be a lamb for slaughter. Oh God, please send anyone, just not my son or daughter. Oh God, please send anyone, send me anywhere, to the left or to the right, as long as I could be back home and in my bed tonight. Another song says, anywhere in this world below, but I don't want to go where it's too hot, where there might be snow. Anywhere, anywhere, it might be a little lie. God, help me want to follow you now, not only when I die. Which brings us to our next point. Paul could rejoice in his circumstances because he knew that he was serving Jesus. And he's facing lots of circumstances, not just his imprisonment, not just his possible death. We'll talk about that in a moment. But we've got to see our circumstances as something that we can push through, something that we can see as opportunities for God. But there are other challenges. Look at Philippians chapter 1, verses 15 through 18. Paul wrote, some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry. Remember, there are those who are being more bold because Paul's in prison. But others are preaching from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I'm put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed. And in that I rejoice. Paul does not have, at this point, the freedom or the flexibility that he was used to. Mentioned Dan Cain earlier. Dan, at the time he moved to Boston, was a single guy. And as a single guy, he could do things that this married guy could not. And you know, I'm glad to be married. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, I would hear of Dan, he's got Bible studies with people at 10 at night. And I'm thinking, I wish I could have Bible studies with people at 10 at night. Now I don't at all. I've gotten older, want to be in bed at 10 at night. But at the time, it was exciting, and he could do things, and he had freedom and flexibility, and Paul had that same kind of thing. He wasn't married, he didn't have children, and so his responsibilities in that realm were very few, and so he could go where he pleased. And if he wanted to take a partner with him, he could. If he didn't, he didn't have to, and so he could just go where he pleased. But now he can't. And he's locked down. And he's stuck. And so there are some people who see this as a sort of vacuum to fill. It's an opportunity for advancement. You know, Paul was the teacher. He was the preacher that everyone wanted to hear. And now we can step in and we can sort of take that spot. And so Paul says there are some people, would-be rivals. They're not really true rivals because Paul doesn't think about it that way. But they see themselves as rivals. And they're going to get the credit that they thought Paul didn't deserve. He's getting too much attention, and these people are ready for their fair share. They are full of envy and rivalry. And in verse 17, they only proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition. And Paul knew that they were only doing it to afflict him in prison. Now, Paul, they might ask, doesn't that bother you? And his response in verse 18, so what? The ESV says, what then? Other translations, what does it matter? What does it really matter? Only that in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice, yes, and I will rejoice. What matters is that Christ gets the attention. These people don't understand. I'm not looking for the attention. I want people to look to Christ, and He gets the attention. And so if they're proclaiming Christ for selfish ambition, but in the meantime, people are hearing that Jesus is Lord, all the more. Who cares? So long as Christ is being proclaimed. Now, we're going to see later in chapter 3 that Paul's not going to put up with false teaching. He's not going to have it. He's going to take a strong stance against it and say some pretty strong words against false teachers. And also, we're going to see in chapter 2, verse 3, that he's not going to approve of self-serving attitudes. He says, do nothing from selfish ambition and conceit. So he's not taking a soft approach to these guys. But his focus here, the way that he's able to maintain joy, the way he's able to rejoice and tell others to rejoice, is that Christ is being proclaimed. His focus on Christ and his love for men who need to hear about Christ, it equips Paul to cope and even to rejoice despite the wounds of his enemies. And that's something that I think you and I can relate to. If my joy is that Jesus is proclaimed as the chosen and anointed one of God, then I can get over personal hurts. I can get over betrayals along the way. Okay, so you're misunderstood. You're taken for granted. People don't appreciate you. Welcome to the club. It's going to happen. It happened to Paul. It happened to Jesus. And so what I can do then is I can appreciate the mission that I'm on and just rejoice that Christ is being glorified. And look, I wish that rivalry and ambition weren't a problem, but it is. You don't raise your hand or answer out loud, but have you ever walked into a room and wondered where you line up? I'm sickened to say that I have. And I thought to myself, well, I'm better than those guys over there. Or walked into another room and said, I'm not where they are. I'll sit further down. And preachers are some of the worst at it. I'm talking to myself. Because we'll hear another sermon and say, that was really, really good. Oh, man, I wish I could do that like that. And we get into this kind of self-talk where we say, I wish I'd had a chance to do that. I would have done a better job than that. Christ is being proclaimed, and that's what matters. And so I need to, instead of looking around the room and looking at other people, where I line up, I need to remember that Christ is in the room. Well, where do I line up with Him? I'll sit further down. You know, I've forgotten someone else is there. And I think I'll just sit a little lower down and cheer on my brothers and sisters. Look at John chapter 3, if you would. In John 3, Jesus and His disciples have begun going around and teaching after Jesus was baptized by John. And Jesus' disciples are baptizing on behalf of Jesus. And it turns out they're baptizing even more than John the Baptist had been baptizing. And so They come to John, and look at verse 26. They come to John and say to him, Rabbi, he who was with you across the Jordan to whom you bore witness, look, he's baptizing, and all are going to him. John answered, person cannot receive even one thing unless it's given him from heaven. You yourselves bear me witness that I said, I'm not the Christ, but I've been sent before him. The one who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom, who stands and hears him, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. Therefore, this joy of mine is now complete. He must increase, but I must decrease. You know, if we would do well to imitate Paul and to imitate John here, I'm not the Christ. You could just say that to yourself. I could say that to myself. I am not the Christ. My joy is complete when all eyes and ears are on Jesus. He must increase. I must decrease. And if we would take that attitude in the church, in our local congregations, what a joy it would be. If we take that attitude in our families, what a delight our homes would be. I'll not forget a time early on when I first began preaching a little. I was filling in with some smaller churches around the surrounding counties. And then I got asked to preach at a local congregation where I was a member, a congregation of about 250, and I was nervous. I don't know, people get nervous for different reasons, but I was nervous. And I remember Miss Judy Moore coming up to me, she's a little old lady, these rosy apple cheeks. She wore earmuffs in July. And she came up and she said, we're all rooting for you. She just wanted to hear about Jesus. And that's what we ought to do, is we ought to say, you know, I'm rooting for you. Root for me. Because we're trying to proclaim Jesus. That's what I do. That's what I'll do. I hope you'll do it too. You'll rejoice when you see good being done because Jesus is being glorified. Now, Paul could have that kind of attitude because Christ was front and center in his mind. But look at the third thing that he's facing. It's death. In Philippians chapter 1, verses 19 through 26, what could be more difficult to face? He says, I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. But I'm hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to depart, be with Christ. That is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain and continue with you all for your progress and joy in the faith, so that in me you may have ample cause to glory in Christ Jesus because of my coming to you again. To live is Christ and to die is gain? Paul, that's crazy talk. But he really believed it. And here's what's incredible. This is the same fella who used to go around persecuting other Christians. And he would convict them and cast his vote against them so that they would go off and after being in prison, they would be killed. What changed? Tell you what changed is that Paul had an encounter with the risen Lord. And so now that he knows that Jesus is not dead but is alive, his ability to think through the passing of death, his understanding of what life is about has completely been transformed. To Paul, death was not the end. It was not the end for his master. It's not going to be the end for him. He's serving a risen Lord. He knew the reality of the resurrection. So faithfulness unto death was a commitment that Paul had made a long time ago. And so when he'd met the master of death on that road to Damascus, his aim became to be with him. And that meant going whatever road he led him down. So if death was that path, so be it. To die is gain. I'll get to go and be with the Lord. But to live meant serving Christ. Paul could find joy in the prospect of death because his hope wasn't in life. But just as important, I hope that we'll see this. It wasn't just that Paul could be comforted about death. It was what it did to the way he lived. Because Julius Caesar said, I'll find plenty of men to die for me. Show me one that will live for me. Paul said, I'm going to choose to live here because it's more important. Paul could serve joyfully in this life because it was what Christ had given him to do. If it was the will of the Lord that Paul should live, then Paul would live not for himself, but for the Lord. If it was the will of the Lord that Paul should die, then Paul would gladly go home. It was the Lord that was calling him. And maybe death, for some of us, seems like a welcome relief. Maybe we're suffering. Maybe we're challenged by emotional difficulties. Maybe we have upcoming decisions. And just to stress it all, say, Lord, come now. But in the meantime, I have an assignment. I have a mission. And I'm going to serve others. Clement, a Christian living in the 2nd or 3rd century, this is a quote from David Burcott from a book called Will the Real Heretics Stand Up? Interesting little book, if you get a chance to read that. But he says that Clement commented that for the average Christian, the cross we are called to bear might be represented by enduring marriage to an unbelieving spouse, obeying unbelieving parents, or suffering as a slave under a pagan master. Although all of those situations could entail much emotional and physical suffering, they were a milder form of the cross for anyone who'd already committed himself to endure torture and death for Christ. Although early Christians endured painful marriages to non-believers, today thousands of Christians are divorcing their believing spouses without hesitation simply because their marriages are less than ideal. Such persons would rather disobey Christ than put up with even mild suffering. I've had Christians tell me that they just couldn't endure living with their spouse any longer in a marriage marked by constant arguments. I wonder what such people will say on Judgment Day to Christian men and women from the early centuries who were able to endure having a red-hot iron poker gouged into their eyes or having their arms torn off or being skinned alive. Why is it that those Christians had the power to endure such excruciating tortures when we often lack the power merely to put up with unpleasant marriages? Maybe it's because we haven't accepted the responsibility of carrying our cross. He goes on to write, saying, several years ago, a Christian woman who was contemplating divorce because her husband and she were not getting along told me through teary eyes, I don't want to have to live like this for the rest of my life. Later, I reflected on the expression she had used, for the rest of my life. I thought about the times that I too had used these words. My use of that expression revealed that heaven wasn't a reality to me, at least not in the sense that my life on earth is a reality. The early Christians readily accepted the message of suffering because their eyes were set on eternity. They didn't think of terms of suffering for the rest of their lives, but as suffering for 50, 60 years at the most. The rest of their lives would be spent in eternity with Jesus. Compared to that, present trials were inconsequential. Like Tertullian, they realized that the leg doesn't feel the chains when the mind is in heaven. That's why Paul and Silas could sing in prison. That's why their praise seemed so strange, but it was because they were behaving as though they believed something that the rest of them just didn't see. So when the earthquake came, the jailer knew he had to ask them, What is it? Let me know. I want to understand how I can be saved. Saved from what? From life. From life here. From being caught up in the drudgery that death is the end. For Paul, it wasn't. He served a risen Lord. Unless the Lord comes first, one day we'll all face death. There's no way around it. 10 out of 10 people die. The question that you and I need to answer is this: will my death be gain? And if you and I are not living for Christ, the answer to will I live? Why live? If it's not for Christ, then death will certainly not be my gain. Perhaps you're in a situation in which you think, again, death might just be better than life. Your heart's cry might be, Lord, take me now. But you've been given a mission. Serve Him, to live as Christ. What if there are people the Lord wants you to serve here? What if you can show a faithful example of what it looks like to endure patiently so that other Christians are encouraged to continue on and be bold, just like Paul was being an example to others to be bold? If you're eagerly, faithfully serving Christ and His people, then whenever the Lord determines you should die, death can only bring you home. And that'll be better. If the worst that can happen to you is that you die, and you know that that's just going to bring you home, you have nothing to fear and every reason to rejoice. Fourth, and finally, really, finally, there's a bit of uncertainty here. I don't know if you catch it here in Philippians chapter 1, but Paul says in verse 22, if I'm to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. He acts as though he has some choice in the matter, as though he can waltz up into Caesar's room and say, look, can we talk about this? I would like these days and these days, and can we just arrange this whole thing? He's, oh, yes, absolutely, Paul. He doesn't get a choice in the matter. But he's acting as though he does. In fact, if you look later in chapter 2 and verse 17, Paul talks about being able to go with him. He says, even if I'm poured out as a drink offering upon the sacrificial offering of your faith, I'm glad and rejoice with you all, even if... You might think, well, Paul's just talking about an imaginary scenario. He knows he's getting out. I think for Paul, it's still a very real possibility that he might be beheaded and killed in prison. Look at verse 23. In chapter 2, verse 23, he says, I hope to send Timothy, therefore, just as soon as I see how it will go with me. And I trust in the Lord that surely I myself will come also. I think Paul had some strong ideas, some strong inclinations that he was going to get out. He was going to get to go and visit with the saints in Philippi. But there's still this level of uncertainty. And I'll tell you one thing that's worse than death is uncertainty. Because what it'll do is it'll drive you to worry and to be anxious and to wish you could control the outcome and call the shots. Paul didn't really know how things were going to go. But he determined that if he could choose, and this is a way to deal with anxiety, this is a way to deal with uncertainty, if he could choose, if the decision were his to make and he could call the shots, he would make up his mind to serve and be a blessing to others. How many times have we fretted over a decision or worried about the outcome? And why? Because, well, we want things to turn out all right. And what we mean by that is we want things to turn out the way that we want them to turn out. We think that our ideas, our plans are what's best. And so when it's in God's hands and we don't know what the outcome is, we're a little anxious about that. God, if you'll give it into my control and do things, can you take some notes here, God, and please do it this way? We wouldn't be so anxious. Doesn't that sound a little prideful? Doesn't that sound like we're wanting to be the one on the throne calling the shots? We just want it our way. But suppose instead of thinking about what would be in our best interest, even though we don't really know what would be in our best interest. Suppose instead that we thought about what other people needed. Suppose we committed first to the cause of Christ. And don't we know that Jesus' way is best anyway? That ultimately His way will lead to joy. Back in John, this time in chapter 15, Jesus here, just a few hours before His arrest, is encouraging His disciples to get a few things straight. And in John 15, verse 9, He says, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abide in his love. Again, this is hours before he's to be arrested, put on trial, and killed. These things I have spoken to you, that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be full. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. So he says, keep my commandments, abide in my love, make your joy full, my joy will be full in you. If you keep my commandments, what commandment? Verse 12, that you love one another as I have loved you. Don't you know that living the way that Jesus lived for the sake of obeying the Father and serving others is how to have the fullest of joys? Paul's facing the kinds of trials that I can only talk about. I've never experienced them. Something similar, we can say, we can relate, but Paul is able to rejoice, and again I say rejoice, and he's saying, I'm going to say it again because it's safe for you, it's good for you. He can say all that because he trusted Jesus, because he wanted nothing more than to please Jesus, because to live is Christ. In other words, Paul rejoiced because he believed. He says in Romans 15, 13, may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that by the power of the Holy Spirit you may abound in hope. Hope these things are encouraging and helpful to you. And pray that God would bless us and help us to keep Him first and to see ways that we can choose to rejoice in Him as we believe in Him. Thank you for your kind attention.